Now, I would like to ask the first panelists to come up and take their seat. Thank you all for your opening speeches, and I can declare the conference to be opened. While the opening speakers would be coming down and the first panelists will be coming up, I will tell you some few remarks concerning the structure of the conference, some technical things, and so on. But first, let me declare that the program, as you may have noticed, is very tight. So during this morning, we don't have any pauses. So please be patient or leave the room silently. I would also like to present our academic partners, not just those two institutions, the representatives of which were speaking before me. Altogether, it's our institute as the main organizer, the Institute for the History of the 1956 Hungarian Revolution in Hungary, Institute for the Investigation of the Crimes of Communism from Romania, Historical Institute of the Academy of Sciences in Slovakia, and Hannah Arendt Center in Sofia, Bulgaria. All the speeches, all the papers went through a peer review process. Altogether, we received over 70 applications. The process of peer review was done by representatives of these institutions and other people that are members of the program committee, named all at your program. I would like to thank them very much for their enormous effort, choosing the best of the best applicants. Concerning the organization of the conference, I think most of you have received a copy of the program, so I won't be describing it in detail. But the first panel, the longest one, called Transitional Justice, would be divided to several parts. Two of them will be held during the morning. Then, if anyone, technically speaking, has got any kind of question, please ask at the registration desk where you have got your business cards. Then all the speeches from the conference would be nearly immediately posted on the website of the institute in the form of MP3 clips. So it will be available to the larger public. Proceedings of the conference would be done during this autumn, but collection of drafts of papers will be available during the lunch break at the registration desk, but is dedicated or it's just for panelists, so please don't take it once you're not part of any panel. Finally, just a few words about the Transitional Justice Panel. It's the main focus of the conference. It serves several purposes, including some kind of structured introduction of this field, which is also a scientific field, to the Czech broader audience, to the scientific community, and so on. So I hope that the discussion, either after each panel or part of panel, or by the end of the conference, would somehow summarize this scientific endeavor. Now, please let me introduce the first panelist, Mr. Michael Kraus. who graduated from Princeton in the United States, Princeton University, and is currently head of international politics and economics department at the Middlebury College, Vermont, USA. His paper is named Reckoning with Former Regimes and Their Legacies in Central and Eastern Europe. So, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vážení přátelé, děkuji organizátorům této důležité konference. Je mi ctí a potěšením se jí účastnit. Příspěvek jsem připravil bohužel anglicky, a tak se českému publiku srdečně omlouvám. Transitional justice aims to provide accountability for past mass atrocity or human rights abuses. Societies and governments have pursued a wide range of justice-serving and truth-seeking measures focused on both the role of perpetrators and the plight of the victims. Approaches and mechanisms which comprise transitional justice include national and international tribunals, vetting of public employees, including the so-called lustration, truth and reconciliation commissions, giving access to the secret police files, property restitutions, truth and reconciliation commissions, rehabilitating and compensating and remembering the victims, and so on. My paper briefly reflects on the 20-year record of dealing with the communist past in East and Central Europe. According to Neil Kritz, one of the contributors to the discussion about, or leading contributors to the discussion about transitional justice, the term transitional justice or transitional justice strategies have four main objectives. The first goal is to determine the truth by establishing a record of human rights abuses. Truth provides validation for victims and is aimed at the instruction of future generations. The second goal is justice. Of course, as we know, justice ideally takes place in an established system of the rule of law and is not transitional. It's full. But transitional justice comes into play when the human rights violations are massive and their scale defies standard procedures of justice. The third objective is the implementation of democratic reforms and leading towards the establishment of the rule of law. Finally, in societies afflicted with large-scale violence, such as genocide, the fourth objective of transitional justice is establishing a durable peace. The order in which I presented these objectives reflects the ascending level of difficulty encountered in attaining them. The experience of many countries suggests that it is more difficult to obtain justice than truth. It is even harder to implement institutional reforms. And Kritz argues that these four objectives I have mentioned also provide the standards by which all transitional justice policies should be evaluated. Now, instead of attempting a full-fledged evaluation of transitional justice policies in East and Central Europe over the past 20 years, in the next 15 minutes, an impossible task, I have four points or observations that I'd like to share with you, and hopefully they will provoke discussion among us, among our audience, and I'm sure a number of other presenters will be dealing with one or another of these aspects. To begin with, it's very hard to generalize about patterns of transitional justice in the entire region. If we simplify the matter a great deal and consider the record of transitional justice to consist of a point on an imaginary line stretching between prosecution and punishment at one end and amnesia and forgiveness at the other, we will immediately be struck by the great deal of divergence in transitional justice policies in East Europe. Most countries fall somewhere between these two extremes. At one end, we find the experience of the former Soviet Union, where the gravest of crimes were committed during the course of more than 70 years of Soviet rule. As we all know, very little justice emerged in post-Soviet Russia, and not much truth-telling either. On the contrary, in May of this year, Russian President Medvedev created an official truth commission of sorts, the purpose of which is not to examine Russia's traumatic past, but rather to counter the alleged falsifications of Russian history taking place, especially in the neighboring countries. Outside of the Baltic countries, the record of other Soviet successor states, the records do not offer much encouragement either. In a recent book, Lavinia Stan examined criminal prosecutions, lustration policies, and access to the secret police archives in Eastern Europe and the post-Soviet states. And she concluded, or she and a team of specialists concluded, that Albania, Slovakia, and Slovenia have adopted forgive and forget strategies, while Germany, Czech Republic, and the three Baltic states pursue transitional justice more vigorously. Possessing the rich store of experience in dealing with a traumatic past, Germany of the 1990s seemed ever determined to settle accounts after communism. Germany became the only country to have, so to speak, done it all. It conducted extensive criminal trials, carried out purges of public employees, established an independent authority, the so-called Gau Commission, to organize and to put to public use the archives of the secret police, and launched a truth commission whose findings analyzed the nature of the communist regime in 15,000 pages. Germany, of course, was an exception insofar as it had already established rule of law institutions at its disposal, including independent judges, prosecutors, lawyers, and so on. Germany was also able to invest the significant resources required to conduct transitional justice on this scale. If these were the reasons why Germany's model of transitional justice was an inspiration to Central and East Europe, they were also the reasons why the model could not be copied or exported anywhere else in the region. My second point can be posed as a question. Why did different countries in the region adopt different strategies of transitional justice? Why the diversity? After all, given the shared legacy of communist totalitarianism and its crimes, witness the title of our conference, one would expect similar responses to dealing with the past. What factors best explain different strategies of transitional justice that countries and governments adopt? Scholars have devoted a fair amount of attention to this question. Among the first to pose it was Samuel Huntington in The Third Wave. His study of some 35 countries that underwent democratization between 1974 and 1990. Huntington noted the wide-ranging moral and legal issues concerning the challenge of what to do about the torturers and their bosses, concluding, and I quote, that in actual practice, what happened was little affected by moral and legal considerations. It was shaped almost exclusively by politics, by the nature of the democratization process, and the distribution of political power during and after the transition. By the distribution of political power during the transition, Huntington meant whether the authoritarian governments exited with strength or fell crippled by weakness. If they exited with strength, they did so typically through protracted negotiations with the opposition, as for example in Poland or Hungary. And this made prosecution of authoritarian officials, according to Huntington, unlikely and ineffective. Were authoritarian governments collapsed or were overthrown, as in East Germany or Czechoslovakia, prosecution was more likely and more likely to be effective if it happened sooner rather than later. Subsequently, other scholars expanded and amended Huntington's findings and propositions, pointing to the importance of additional factors such as the character of the preceding regime, the nature of its crimes, the population's experience with pluralism even prior to dictatorship, the attitudes, beliefs, and values of both opposition, of the opposition and the new elites, and the role of international norms and actors. In one of the most compelling analyses of post-totalitarian justice, at least in my view, Abiezer Tucker, for example, agrees with Huntington, remarking that, quote, decisions whether to engage in transitional justice depended largely on the balance of political power between the post-communist and non-communist political elites. When former communists returned to power in this region around 1993-94, they were able to block transitional strategies, transitional justice policies from proceeding. Furthermore, Tucker analyzed Huntington's transition types in conjunction with past legacies to argue that post-totalitarian transitions were fundamentally different from post-authoritarian transitions, from transitions from authoritarian regimes. Weak civil societies, typical for post-totalitarian transitions, were ill-equipped to contend with the ranks of the nomenclatura who led the quest for power amongst the new political elites. Since Professor Tucker is addressing this subject next, I'll let him speak for himself. My third observation concerns the different forms that transitional justice took in post-communist Europe as compared with other regions, such as, for example, Latin America. While selective and often unsuccessful attempts at prosecuting and punishing former officials of predecessor regimes took place on both continents, lustration and the opening of secret police archives became the dominant mode of transitional justice in post-communist Europe. By contrast, everywhere else, truth commissions emerged as the main vehicle of transitional justice. According to Amnesty International, beginning in 1974, when the third wave of democratization started, to 2007, at least 33 truth commissions were established in 28 countries of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. But apart from Germany, no truth commission appeared in East and Central Europe. Olivia Stan, in her book, Without Explaining Why, notes that truth commissions were never seriously considered in post-communist countries, although Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union alike could greatly benefit from both truth-telling and national reconciliation. Other commentators, such as Timothy Garton Ash, have repeatedly made the same point, emphasizing how and why truth commissions would assist the post-communist societies to establish an authoritative account of the crimes of the past. A decade ago, Ash suggested that the absence of truth commissions, I quote, seems to lie in the combination of two elements. First, the historically defensible but also comfortable conviction that the dictatorship was ultimately imposed from outside, and second, the uneasy knowledge that almost everyone had done something to sustain the dictatorial system. Why have no truth commissions materialized in East and Central Europe? This is an intriguing question and one I'll leave to our discussion to debate. But parenthetically, I would like to note that the recent rise of various institutions bearing names such as the Polish Institute of National Remembrance, Slovak Institute of National Memory, and the Czech Institute for the Study of Totalitarian Regimes, our host today, which are responsible for managing the secret police archives as well as directing research and analysis. I wonder to what extent they can, or even should, act as surrogate truth commissions. What conditions would have to be met for them to be able to do so? Perhaps that's another question we can tackle in our discussion. My fourth and final observation will take us back to 1989 so that we may put the overall record of transitional justice into a fuller relief. While many scholars have focused on the question of why countries adopted different transitional strategies, what strikes at least this observer as especially significant in light of the devastation wrought by communist regimes over the previous four decades, what strikes me today is the relative absence of retributive justice and the overall moderation of demands for punishment throughout the region, as well as the adoption of relatively mild measures to cope with this traumatic past. Let us remember that soon after the collapse of communism in Eastern Central Europe in 1989, especially following the passage of the first lustration law in Prague in October 1991, Western human rights activists, including the Helsinki Watch, leading lawyers, prominent media outlets such as the New York Times or the New York Review of Books, prominent at least in the USA, warned against the excesses of decommunization in East Europe, expressing grave concerns about witch hunts in Prague and invoking the specter of McCarthyism haunting the region. Within a couple of years, however, it became apparent, as Stephen Holmes put it in mid-1994, that, and I quote, "the dreaded witch hunts have completely failed to materialize, for the public appetite for purchase has proved vanishingly small." Thus, for Holmes, the unexpected turn away from decommunization, or in his words, the startling absence of retributive politics, was what needed an explanation. "Why no Inquisition in East Europe?" Holmes asked. The short answer to Holmes' question, in my view, is that the lustration issue was vastly, if not willfully, misunderstood, the data misreported, and the fears exaggerated. Jerry Laber of Helsinki Watch, for example, reported in 1992 that perhaps 1 million citizens of Czechoslovakia might be affected by lustration. Tony Judd, a prominent historian, similarly alarmed his readers by stating that every former and current Communist Party member was subject to lustration. But both statements were completely erroneous and wide of the mark. By contrast, Holmes estimated in 1994 that documented misbehavior had seriously affected the careers of a few hundred people at most in the Czech Republic. In 1995, Luke Heise compared and contrasted transitional justice in post-war Belgium, France, and the Netherlands with those of post-communist Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Poland. He concluded that when dealing with their traumatic past, the regimes born of the Velvet Revolutions showed much more restraint and moderation and paid much more attention to rule of law considerations than their West European counterparts did after the Second World War. In 2006, 12 years after Holm posed his question about the absence of Inquisition, John Elster also concluded that one might have expected more extensive retribution measures in post-communist countries. Characterizing the level of successful prosecutions in the Czech Republic and Germany as low, and describing this as a puzzle. How is one to resolve this puzzle and explain the absence of Holm's Inquisition in East Europe in the past two decades? In seeking to do so, Elster invokes the possibility that the sheer passage of time may account for differences in patterns of transitional justice. He argues that the hunger for punishment, or what he calls the retributive emotions, tend to decay over time, as does the intensity of the demand for retribution. Given that the biggest wave of communist crime swept East Europe in the late 1940s and the early 1950s, demands for prosecution and punishment were by no means as pronounced by the mid-1990s as many Western observers had initially assumed. In practice, they were often mitigated by other concerns stemming from preoccupation, not with the past, but with the present, such as economic concerns, for example. Like other scholars, Elster also mentions the scarcity of resources and the shortage of competent and untainted legal personnel as limiting factors in retributive justice. At the same time, Elster neglects to analyze the restraining influence of the international factors and actors. In my view, international conventions on human rights, membership in the Council of Europe, and the country's prospective membership in the European Union transformed the legal and political environment in which East Europe conducted its transitional policies in the 1990s and beyond. Be that as it may, the overall record of transitional justice in post-communist Europe has hardly satisfied anyone in the region. To take one measure, only a few communist party leaders and secret police operatives were actually prosecuted. Fewer still were sent to jail. Of those, even fewer actually served any jail time. Amnesties, statutes of limitations, ill health of the perpetrators, incompetent or complicit judiciaries, all of these factors made themselves felt. It is worth recalling that Huntington concluded his analysis of this issue, prosecute and punish versus forgive and forget, by imploring potential democratizers to recognize that each alternative presents grave problems and that the least unsatisfactory course may well be do not prosecute, do not punish, do not forgive, and above all, do not forget. Whether by design or by default, willingly or reluctantly, East and Central Europe seems to have embraced the least unsatisfactory course. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Krauss, thank you very much for your comprehensive introduction to the field of transitional justice. I've got just a few more remarks concerning the panel and the organization. I forgot to set out a rule, so it doesn't apply to you, but the rule is 15 minutes, the maximum for each speech. We see the discussion which would come after each part of the panel as essential part of the conference, and we would like to use it for that purpose. We are now at the Minister of Culture, Konierna, at the Nostitz Palace, and we are grateful that the Minister of Culture agreed to be a co-organizer of the conference. Also, the conference has been supported by EU program at the EACEA Europe for Citizens program, Action 4. Thank you for that. And the last thing is that if you're using your computers, there's a wireless access to the internet in this room and in the lobby, so you can ask for the password at the registration desk. Now, please let me welcome Mr. Aviezer Tucker, who just recently wrote a book called The Legacies of Totalitarianism, a Political Theory of Post-Totalitarianism, and deals with the subject from different points throughout the last 20 years, let's say. So, please, welcome.
Thank you. I'm not used to speaking with a light in my eyes. Maybe some of the former political prisoners here could advise me how to handle that. I think it was Kierkegaard who said that we live our lives forward and we understand them backward. 20 years after the end of communism, I think there are certain patterns that we can finally see as we look backward to see, to understand historical change in terms that were not available to us while the events were actually unfolding. Namely, that change did not take an equal pace, did not proceed evenly in various aspects of life. Firstly, if we look from a global perspective, undoubtedly 1989 was a year of revolution. Americans who wouldn't be able to point to Europe on a map had their life changed in a far more radical fashion than many people who actually lived in Eastern Europe. The lifting of the borders, the creation of a global market for commodities, ideas, and people revolutionized the lives of people who lived very, very far from Central Europe, in places like rural China, in places like the United States. A number of international conflicts that were sustained by the Cold War disappeared. A number of conflicts within multinational totalitarian states that were suppressed by communism emerged. While we can talk about a global revolution, in the political realm we can talk about change, not a revolution. And when we talk about the social level, I think we see a greater degree of continuity than either the political or the global level. In a sense, what I'm arguing for here is the opposite of what Brodel argued in his analysis of European history. He argued that there are very slow, long-duration changes that take millennia, that are usually global in perspective, that political changes take a shorter period of time. I argue, actually, that the global change is much quicker than in the last 20 years than the local change. If you want to compare that metaphorically, we can compare it to an express train, a quick train, and a slow local train. The focus of my talk today will be on the slow train. And one more. Thank you. If we look at the political changes, what is the meaning of a political change? Well, political change means that there is a change in the political elite, that the type of people who rule the country are different from the people who used to rule it before communism. In that respect, there were multiple 1989s, and in some places there was no 1989. In Romania and Bulgaria, 1989 happened 10 years after 1989 happened in Prague or in Budapest or in Warsaw. In Russia, 1989 never happened because there was no replacement of the elites. I would argue that the Whether or not an elite, a political elite, was replaced depended exclusively on the existence of a dissident movement. Of course, there's a lot that we can criticize Havel and Pithart, but I would not forget that had there not been a Havel and Pithart in this country, Adamets and Schalfau, people very much like them, would have gone on ruling this country for another decade or so, just as they have in places like Bulgaria and Romania. What is unique about totalitarianism is that in order for a totalitarian regime to establish itself, it must eliminate about 10% of the population. That would include all actual elites, potential elites, imaginary elites, anything that could possibly compete with the totalitarian elite. So you have to kill or imprison or expel about 10% of the population. Once that is established, the totalitarian regime must control all channels of upper mobility, the universities, jobs, and so on. That means that by the time totalitarianism is finally ready to go, is finally ready to leave, there's practically nobody to replace it. And that's where the significance of the dissident movements, however small and weak and inexperienced they were, comes into play. Because they were the ones who were able to take away the keys from the communists and at least replace the elite in politics and create political change. On the other hand, when it comes to all the other elites in society, we see that there is a greater degree of continuity for the simple reason that there is nobody to replace the existing elites. There's nobody to replace the judges, which is very important when it comes to transitional justice. Usually, after 1989, about 10% of the judges had to leave, but that means that 90% of them remained, and those who could replace them through normal generational change were the ones who were educated, obviously, in law schools, which were run pretty much by the same people according to the same criteria, and so on. That limits the possibilities any transitional government, any new democratic government, can actually control the process of change in society when there is such a continuity in all the alternative institutions to the government, when there's nobody to replace the existing elites. Now, in 1989, there were a number of theories that I would like to dismiss very quickly. The belief that there is a democratic teleology, that the historical process must lead towards some sort of a democratic end, I think was falsified by Mr. Putin. I think that is his main contribution to democratic theory. There's no compulsion that we will end up. There's no evolutionary process that would lead us to democracy. That is, it's true that countries that don't have the rule of law and don't have free markets and don't have democracy are going to fail eventually. But the units of selection are not necessarily countries in this evolutionary process. It can be small groups of people who would benefit from a continuing state of non-rule of law and non-free markets. They would benefit, of course, from economic inequality and would use the system manipulate it to maintain the benefits that they had from the old regime. And that indeed reflects the elite continuity after 1989. Oh. Let's go.
Right.
I hope you can see that table out there. There's a basic distinction, I think, between post-totalitarian regime and post-authoritarian regime, which Michael Krauss referred to earlier. There are just some things in transitional justice that post-authoritarian regimes can do that post-totalitarian regimes just cannot do. The reason for that is that authoritarian regimes are interested in suppressing only the political competitors. On average, my research showed that they have to eliminate about 0.1% of the population by killing them or jailing them or expelling them, 0.1% of the population. By comparison, a totalitarian regime must eliminate 10% of the population. You can compare, for example, two countries of roughly the same size, Argentina and Hungary. You will discover that in Argentina, the number of people who were murdered by the junta was a bit over 10,000. In Hungary, it was nearly 1.5 million. Were imprisoned, not necessarily killed, but imprisoned in the gulags immediately after the communist takeover. Some of them were sent to the Soviet Union. Now, that means two things. It means, firstly, that the demands on the system, on the legal system, on the democratic system, after there is democracy, are immeasurably larger in post-totalitarian states than in post-authoritarian states. It also means that since the authoritarian states are only interested in suppressing their political enemies, there are alternative elites to take over. There are alternative judges, there are alternative lawyers, there are alternative academics to educate new judges and new lawyers. Partly also because authoritarian regimes typically do not corrupt the legal system. When they need to torture or kill or murder somebody, they create death squads. Now, the nice thing about death squads, there's a silence here, the nice things about death squads is that they don't corrupt the legal system. It means that the judges can throw the first stone once the death squads go home. They can catch them. They can put them in jail because they were not involved. The police was not involved. Lawyers were not involved. So the possibilities of transitional justice are just immeasurably larger in a post-authoritarian context. Whereas under totalitarianism, there was no independent legal profession. There was no independent legal system. The legal profession was subjected to the executive. And that means that by habit and by loyalty, these people are just not going to execute transitional justice. They're just they're going to block it, and they're going to block it not just in the post-communist context, but look at any post-totalitarian experience, including West Germany, including Japan. It's exactly the same story. There are elite continuities, there's no transitional justice. The only transitional justice that you will find in West Germany and in Japan when institutions just cease to exist. Of course, the SS just ceased to exist, so there was no more SS. Same thing about the Japanese Secret Service. But elsewhere, the judges of the old regime, and there was nobody to replace them, are just not going to convict anybody. They're going to find someone, they're going to shuffle their feet, they're going to move papers around, they're going to prolong trials, they're going to apply incredible rules of evidence, but in the end, there's not going to be transitional justice. The same similar problem happens when you want to compensate the victims, because the number of victims in totalitarian countries is so much larger than in authoritarian countries, and also typically totalitarian regimes ruin the economy much more than authoritarian regimes. The resources are simply not there. Not just the resources for compensation, but the legal resources, just the number of people who would be trained handle this problem. So what do post-totalitarian governments do typically? What I argue is that, in fact, there is no such thing as transitional justice because that assumes the old teleology that I don't like. I think what we have is rough justice. Last slide. By rough justice, I mean justice that is saving on the expenses of administering justice by making it rougher, by using criteria of collective responsibility, of the sort of thing that you will find not just in lustration, but also in restitution. When you say just somebody who has a certain document is entitled to get a certain property. Now, maybe the document is forged. Maybe somebody has a right to that property, but they lost the document. It's been 50 years. But if you want to have just a bureaucratic committee that can handle justice very quickly, you're going to use exactly this sort of rough estimate. The same thing is general amnesty, which is something that at the beginning of every post-totalitarian government, this is a measure that needs to be taken. But in general amnesty, it means you are releasing not just the political prisoners and the people who are convicted of non-political crime for political reasons, you're also going to release people who may have done what they were convicted of doing. But there's just no resources to distinguish between those groups of people. So you just use rough criteria. And my final argument is that actually you will find the same phenomenon of rough justice in established liberal democracies when they are confronted with a problem of administering a huge number of cases without enough resources. And the two examples would be affirmative action in the United States, when the American government in the late 60s wanted to protect the rights of African Americans and provide them access to jobs and employment, it was just not practical to put on every committee that admits students, on every committee that gives jobs to people, a representative of the federal government. So instead of that, you just put abstract criteria, say the percentage of African Americans in the population is so-and-so, so this is the percentage of African Americans who need to study here or to work here. And in, at Harvard University, the admission of African Americans, I believe, is up to the second decimal point of the percentage of the population, that precise. It's very rough, but it works. Similar thing you will see about something called Megan's Law, which is a law that is designed to deal with released pedophiles. The percentage of recidivism among pedophiles is much higher than among normal criminals because of their compulsions. It's a bit like communist apparatchik, they have to steal. The way to deal with that is, if you want to keep to the traditional criteria of rule of law, is to put 6 policemen on each released pedophile, 3 shifts, 2 policemen per person, and then that person will never commit the crime again. That's a bit expensive. So what Megan's Law in the United States does is it instructs local councils, local government, to advertise in the community the identity of the released criminal. Now, that violates, of course, the right of the criminal to start new life and not be known, and so on. But because it is so expensive to do it the right way, the American government decided to do it, or rather governments of individual states decided to employ a rough criteria, which is, again, quite similar to lustration in that respect of protecting the public from a potential criminal. Here I'll stop.
Mr. Decker, thank you very much for your comparative framework or comparative view on the determinants or settings of transitional justice after different types of regimes. Now, there should be Harold Elbasani and Arthur Lipinski speaking. I'm not sure whether they're present. If they are, please will be welcomed here. And if they aren't, I would like to introduce the last speaker of this part of the first panel, Jakub Jirsa. Jakub Jirsa is a philosopher, graduated from Philosophical Faculty in Prague. Central European University, and has spent time at Cambridge and deals with broad issues also connected with transitional justice, but from the philosophical point of view.
Thank you very much. If Michael Kraus apologized to the Czech part of the audience for speaking in English, I feel that since I will do the same, my apologies have to go to native speakers. So sorry for mumbling in English. Transitional justice, in its usual meaning, can be defined as, and now I took an example of the definition from Rudi Tetel's 2003 work, the conception of justice associated with periods of political change characterized by legal responses to confront the wrongdoing of the repressive predecessor regimes. In this sense, the transitional justice forms the first and the most visible part of what is usually called coming to terms with the past, or in German, Aufarbeitung der Vergangenheit. It is the first, since each and every new regime claims to be legitimate and righteous in applying justice to the wrongdoings of the old regime from the very beginning of its new rule. And it is the most visible part of coming to terms with the past, since it is administered by public institutions, and in many cases before the eyes of the public, by media, by television, and all the other sorts. In the following paper, I will focus on one issue which belongs to the broad conception of coming to terms with the past, and which closely belongs to the international justice in the above-defined sense. Transitional justice operates primarily with the concept of guilt. According to its definition, it deals with the legal responses. I will try to show, or I will try to argue, that it's not only guilt, but the concept of shame that is present in coming to terms with our past, and that it actually helps to reach several aims of transitional justice, which lie beyond the scope of legal and juridical institutions. In the first part, I will discuss some shortcomings of the transitional justice focused solely on the legal charges. Many victims of wrongs committed under the past regime mention that a correct and adequate appraisal of the past is quite enough for their retribution and justice as they perceive it. What they want and what the justice actually demands is recognition of the victims as victims and the wrongdoers as wrongdoers. In the terms of guilt and in the legal framework, this simple demand presents a serious challenge for each and every society in transition. The diversity of wrongs and suffering naturally does not allow for any collective solution that would be potentially fully just. The number of wrongdoers is usually so high that it is not possible to fully apply the legal charges. Moreover, the memories of injustice are often informal and personal. For example, when a party member uses his influence and power to bully and intimidate his neighbor, it is not the kind of wrong which usually belongs to crimes rectified during the periods of transitional justice. However, it is still a wrong and harm done. There is still guilt, we have the wrongdoer, and we have the victim. For several reasons, the transitional justice under the earlier definition seems to be inevitably partial and imperfect. The transitional justice trials operate within the field of criminal justice, and as such they must deal with individual accountability. But wrongs committed under the former regime often happen with the so-called gray zone of collaborators and passive supporters. Therefore, this conception of transitional justice has a too narrow focus to accommodate all of these past wrongs. These problems serve as arguments for the thick line behind the past. This thick line can have several interpretations. According to one presented in the literature, it does not necessarily mean avoidance of the judgment, but the view that justice needs to be seasoned not so much by compassion for its own sake as by a concern for the future. Well, this utilitarian view focused on the future is, I believe, only part of the whole picture. On the other hand, yet another interpretation of the thick line is expressed in Goethe's Faust in the line, "Es ist so gut, als wäre es nie gewesen." It's as good as if it never happened. The speaker is, with no surprise, Mephistopheles. Under this interpretation, the thick line is actually a complete amnesia, killing of the memory. I believe that focus on guilt and legal sanctions is only part of coming to terms with our past. In the following, I will briefly discuss the difference between guilt, which underlines the above discussed conception of justice, and shame. In the concluding part, I will demonstrate that shame-based approach actually occurs in parts of Czech, however imperfect, dealing with our past, and what might be its possible advantages. The feeling of guilt arises when one acknowledges that what one did was something wrong, that one transgressed some rule or a minimal norm. If one does not recognize his actions as wrong, one cannot feel guilty. But even in this situation, guilt can be assigned to him by an external body, by a court. However, this guilt assignment is not a reason for anyone to feel guilty and acknowledge the guilt. Within the process of assigning the guilt, our assumed wrongdoer is considered to be an object ready to be treated, accused, sentenced, punished, and re-educated. Of course, the guilt is connected with remorse. However, remorse and possible betterment does not follow from the fact that someone is found guilty, but only from the fact that someone actually feels guilty. When focused on the shame-pride distinction, actions, on the other hand, are evaluated in comparison with a certain model or standard. Whereas guilt is grounded in transgression of the rule, shame is basically a response on failing to live according to the norms of decency. The transgression of a rule is always yes or no case, and this characteristic is reflected in the verdict guilty or not guilty. Shame, on the other hand, does allow for a judgment on a certain scale, i.e. it allows for more or less. Shame and pride are essentially linked with value concept or moral concepts. Guilt, assessed by a tribunal, is directly linked with the law. Our actions, remind us, Bernard Williams, point in one direction towards what has happened to others, in another direction to what I am. Guilt focuses only on first direction, towards the others. It does not have and does not require any reflexive relation towards oneself. Shame, on the other hand, looks to what I am, what character I have, how I behave towards myself during my life. Therefore, we can conclude that the structures of shame contain the possibility in controlling and learning from guilt, because they give a conception of one's ethical identity, in relation to which guilt can make sense. Shame can understand guilt, but, so to say, guilt can't understand properly itself. Being ashamed is often put into relation with humiliation. If it were so, my entire project collapses, since it would be perverted to base an interpretation of transitional justice on something like humiliation. Of course, humiliation can pathologically result into the shame of the humiliated victim. This, however, is not a typical result of humiliation, and it is not a proper response to it either. For example, anger, resistance, resentment are more appropriate or do occur in psychological findings quite more often than shame. Humiliation is basically a rejection of human beings as human. Humiliating behavior treats other people as if they were not worth of any attention. On the other hand, the act of shaming someone in many instances presupposes that we treat the other person as a human being who is actually capable of change and capable of change in his or her behavior. The sentence, shame on you, don't dare to do it again, is an example of what one says in connection with shame. If we assume the other is capable of shame, we presuppose that he or she is a human being. And even those who criticize the concept of shame acknowledge that shame has a social aspect which is crucial for my entire project, and that one feels ashamed because of not living in accordance with the norms of decency settled in a given society. Shame includes and is based on a concern with others' evaluation of the self, and in this way it allows the society to choose its approach toward the wrongdoers of past regimes. Shaming is in this respect a response to wrongdoing, which I take analogous to assigning guilt and subsequent punishment. I don't mean that one can replace the other one. I merely want to claim that these are analogous and they do both belong under the heading of dealing with our past. As I try to show above, the concept of shame allows for legal amnesty without amnesia. It is a form of evaluating past wrongs. It keeps distance between the victims and the wrongdoers, and it names the victims and wrongdoers. On the other hand, it does not rely on juridical principles which, as I briefly mentioned at the beginning of the paper, are often insufficient and necessarily partial. One could object that the mechanism of shame does more harm than benefit. It divides the society instead of uniting it after the period of transition. However, we talk about the period of transition within which both guilt and shame mechanisms function as cleansing and healing devices enabling a common future. Concerning separation from the rest of the society, it does not seem to be any stronger or lasting longer than the effects of punishment after an assigned guilt. Now, before I conclude, I briefly introduce some examples of shame mechanisms of coming to terms with the past. Authors dealing with the social emotions, amongst which shame belongs, agree that the self is under a continuous and constant social monitoring. Seeing ourselves through the eyes of the others simply belongs to our life, since we are social beings endowed with the capacity for self-reflection. Further, it is no surprise to say that social monitoring usually gives rise to feeling of shame and pride. Shame can be socially constructed, and as such, it can be a part of a coming to terms with the past. During the last 6 years, there were at least 4 petitions that touched dealing with the past and communist heritage in the Czech Republic. Most of them focused on the increasing preferences of the Communist Party, which nowadays represents the resentment in our society. These petitions had the main features all in common. All of them included moral evaluation of the past communist regime. All of them mentioned or called for the law which described the communist regime as an illegal form of the rule, and each and everyone called for an expulsion of the Communist Party from the official political dialogue. However, only one, the Prague Declaration from 2008, entails the claim for legal and juridical sanctions against the perpetrators or wrongdoers of past crimes and wrongs. I do not think it is the case that the authors of other petitions were not aware of the past crimes and refused the possibility of legal responses to them. But it seems that the main idea behind these petitions is quite different. To find a response to the past wrongs which would A. satisfy the victims, B. reflect the character of wrongdoing, C. affect the wrongdoers, and D. which would not involve imperfect and in many cases insufficient legal solutions. All of the petitions supposed that the past wrongs and present insufficient reflection of these wrongs sets the perpetrators and their political heirs outside the sphere of a common decency. In this way, I see the principle of shame as a possible alternative trait of transitional justice. Actually, shame and guilt both involve our reactions to others, and each is an expression of our acceptance of the first principles of right and justice. Focused on the results of different ways of dealing with past, it's hard to say which one works better. Forgetting, forgiving, justice, each one has its pitfalls and advantages. The mechanisms of shame form a natural counterpart to mechanisms of guilt. They do allow for a value-based judgment of past acts, yet shame does not entail a direct link to legal charges and punishments, which, as I try to show above, are often hardly applicable. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ehla, thank you very much for introducing a concept that usually does not play any significant role within the debate about transitional justice. Now a discussion should follow. We've got something more than 10 minutes for the discussion. The rules are very simple. There will be an assistant with a portable microphone. She's going not to give it to you, but to give you a chance to speak to it. There will be 3 questions collected. Please direct them to one of the panelists, not all of them, and say the name of the person you're asking, and then they'll be answering. Thank you. So, any questions, please? So there's the gentleman over there, then the second one over there, and the lady at the leather, at the back.
Slyšíte mě? Můžeme? Já bych se tady vás ne něco zeptal, ale chtěl bych vás pochválit, pane Krauzi. To bylo, úplně mě to překvapilo, když vy jste použil to slovíčko několikrát, decommunization. I love it. Protože já si to překládám do češtiny vyhladit. A obyčejně vyhlazujeme kákorouče, blechy, myši a takovýhle zvířata, které nám obtěžují životy. Tak já jsem teď trošku bohatší v angličtině o jeden výraz, který je, zní tak inteligentně, ale já ho prostě to miluju. A další otázku bych měl k tomu pánovi tamhle, ten druhý,
pane, jak tam...
Your name is Tucker? Sir, you had over there on top a little while ago, tam bylo jedno slovičko, sakra, já už to teď zapomněl. Promiňte, zapomněl jsem to. To se stává, já už taky nejsem nejmladší, víte, a tak už taky mě to postihlo.
Když tak vám dám ještě slovo, a prosil bych druhou otázku tady. Vepředu, dostanete hned mikrofon.
Yeah, I'm Jürgen Müller, and I can ask you in English, but I would prefer to put it in German because it's for me it's a little no. I tried in English, Mr. Jeser. I appreciate this concept very much, but we in our European Christian, not Jewish Christian, but especially Christian tradition, have a little problem with the complex of shame, because we are in the Christian tradition, we are all sinners. And this makes problem to make differentiation. I'll give you a historical example from the German society after war. When the Americans put in jail the main criminals of war, there were big activities of the Protestant church. They rang the bell because we are all sinners, and the Catholic Church, the Vatican, helped the many of the criminals of war to escape to Southern America because we are all sinners. So there is some contradiction, some problem in this concept, which from the human side I appreciate very much.
Thank you very much. There was a third question, a lady at the back.
I would also like to ask a question to Mr. Tucker. I enjoyed your presentation a lot, and thanks a lot for the neat and clarifying distinction between totalitarian and authoritarian regimes. Only I doubt if you could apply that, for instance, to Poland in the 80s. Because I would agree that perhaps this model works if there would have been a transition in 56, but I wonder if you could seriously call Poland a totalitarian regime in this respect, and if you disagree, then please explain quickly why. And if you don't disagree, then what would your model imply for the Polish case? Thank you very much.
Thank you. So this round of question posing is over. Now first... Mr. Yoza, a question about general shame and specific shame.
Oh, thank you very much, and I do indeed agree. There are perhaps two things which I would like to respond. Yes, you are absolutely right, and my stress on shame, which didn't realize what you just said, might be simply based on coming from Czech Republic and from Central Eastern Europe, where exactly the Christian morality is not the overwhelming one, and therefore the notion of the shame can function pretty well. On the other hand, I'm quite not sure if the notion of the original sin actually makes a person sort of say whether it cancels all the possible evaluation of all other wrongs which he does within his life, and therefore makes any social response inadequate or impossible. On the other hand, there is even one possible stronger objection with which I will have to deal in the future, and that was already in Elias's account of modern society, and namely, if we talk about modern society, we do talk about a society without shame, which is not a shame-based society. But thanks.
Thank you very much. Next question was on Mr. Tucker about the limits of applicability of totalitarianism to late communism.
Right. Arguably, Poland has always been an exception to the totalitarian model because of the independence of the Catholic Church. Now, during the 80s, there was another independent organization, of course, Solidarity. But for that reason, and you add to that the putsch in 81, where the center of power was in military rather than the secret police, which is, again, a major distinction. Certainly Poland in the 80s had very strong authoritarian rather than totalitarian aspects. But the totalitarian aspect of Polish society was still dominant for the variables that are important for traditional justice, namely the composition of the courts. How did the judges become judges? The number of judges. I don't remember the exact statistics for Poland, but in the Czech Republic, in Charles University, the entry class for law school in 1934 was 5,000. In the 1950s, it was 150. In the 1980s, it rose to 650. So just the number of people who are there capable of administering justice, I'm sorry, is much lower. So as far as the composition of who are and the content of the education in the law school, what kind of education, all these things are missing there, which are if you look at places like Argentina and Chile, law schools were independent, number of students was high, the judges were not corrupted. So once the balance of power shifts, shifts. Once the junta is unable anymore to try and do another coup d'etat, then activist judges start acting in Chile and in Argentina. That's just impossible in Poland. Just one correction there about guilt. I feel very guilty. I try to take care of it once a year on Yom Kippur, and then I feel better. But believe me, living in Prague, Jews feel guilty.
Thank you. We've got few more minutes for three more questions, and we'll end up with this part by three more questions, if there are any.
Světnička Právnická fakulta. Prosím vás, jak je možné hovořit o spravedlnosti, případně víně a podobně, když vlastně o tom rozhodují ve smyslu soudcovské spravedlnosti lidé, kteří naopak pomáhali udržovat ten režim. To znamená, že oni nemají pocit viny nebo vůbec nějakého přístupu k tomu, že ta minulost byla nějaká špatná, byť třeba zákon tvrdí, že byl ten režim zločinný. Vedle toho prostě byla tady zmínka o pedofilech, nebo dejme tomu i vrazi. Těch můžeme napočítat ve statistikách hodně, ale to, že by tady vlastně udržovatelé toho režimu nějak byli odsuzováni, to v žádném případě, protože ta spravedlnost je vlastně vznikla za doby totality a oni sami si vlastně nevypustí svůj vlastní rybník. Vys usnesení třeba UVKSČ z 6. ledna 90, kdy soudruhy varovali, potěšili tím, že justice stále zůstává v jejich rukou. To znamená, že spravedlnost neexistuje.
Thank you. One more question, if there's any. Gentleman over there.
Marek Benda, dobrý den. Já na pana Klímu jednu otázečku, možná na všechny. Není ten problém, to vyrovnání v té východní Evropě s komunismem, v tom, že ten Západ ten komunismus nechtěl odsoudit? Že ten Západ nebyl připraven prohlásit komunismus za zločinecký režim, stejně tak jako obdobně, jako to udělal po druhé světové válce s nacionálním socialismem? A vy jste to trošku naznačil v tom rychlém odsudku, který přišel na lustrace, ale ty odsudky jsme přece dostávali dnes a denně. Ty soudce zákaz toho, že nesmíme soudce mít jenom na přechodnou dobu, že si nesmíme vymýšlet soudce, které povoláme z jiných než právnických profesí, to všechno přicházelo z toho Západu. Nebyl ten problém v tom, že ten Západ nechtěl odsoudit ten komunismus?
Oh, thank you. So the first question was, I suppose, posed to Avitakar and dealt with old judicial structures in the new settings and their capability of justice.
Right. As far as intended preservation of the old legal structure, you will find that much more in Hungary, especially in the composition of the first Hungarian Constitutional Court after the transition. And that was a very activist court. They tried to block privatization, block lustration. That was certainly something that was intended. In this country, what you would have is rather the opposite, that they try to appoint to the Constitutional Court the best people they had, rather than the other way around. But my point was rather that it is impossible, after all these years of totalitarianism, to create overnight a legal system, a rule of law. So lustration, Mr. Benda accused the West, which was a bit monolithic, I think. Not all the West, you know, I'm also the West. Possibilities of recreating a rule of law were rather limited. And it's a process that's going to take a couple of generations. So lustration reflected, I think, the impossibility of having a standard normal rule of law rather than created a situation of the rule of law. Now, when it comes to the West, I think it's very important not to have a monolithic description is just the West is all the same. I mean, there's a difference between a few liberal journalists in New York who just thought that the communist apparatchiki from the SDB were Charlie Chaplin and Bertolt Brecht, and it was McCarthy all over again, and more sophisticated political scientists who actually understood what was going on here. The usual mistakes of Western political scientists was to just take several assumptions that are true about mature liberal democratic societies and assume it's the same thing in post-communist world, that there are available judges, that it is possible to have due process and it's possible to have trials for thousands and thousands of people, that once you abolish an institution, the people who compose that institution pose no longer any problem, which is, again, these are all false assumptions, but in terms of percentage of the people, I think this is a tiny, the number of Americans or Europeans who know what lustration is probably 0.0 something, so I wouldn't just say the worst. Just last point, Nino, the Argentinian political scientist, said if everybody is guilty, then nobody is guilty. So if you want transitional justice, just condemning all the communists like Vermin and so on, that's not productive. That means if you just consider the percentage of people in this country who were at one time members of the Communist Party or close family members of members of the Communist Party, this is going to be counterproductive, because you would end up with alienating a very large percentage of the population. So if you want to have transitional justice, it has to be very precise and limited to a small section of the population.
Thank you. The last question was posed to Mr. Kraus about the West.
Já jsem chtěl ještě poděkovat panu Palmerovi za jeho slovo. Je důležité poslouchat také oběti, a on patří mezi ty nejprominentnější oběti tohoto režimu. Co se týče té otázky, co položil pan Marek Benda, to je, myslím, zajímavá a důležitá otázka. Ta podstata věci ovšem spočívá v tom, že prostě ten pád komunismu se ve své podstatě lišil od pádu nacismu, když jsme tedy u dekomunizace a denacifikace, alespoň v tom základním poznatku, že partnerem Západu v destrukci komunismu byl generální tajemník UV Komunistické strany Sovětského svazu Michail Gorbačov. Takže myslím, že byl pocit v Bílém domě, že jaksi ten už jenom podstatě tohle partnerství vyžadovala určitou, řekl bych, restraint tedy, a to znamená omezování v rámci jakýchsi oslav nad vítězstvím ve studené válce. A druhý podstatný rozdíl byl, že po vítězství ve druhé světové válce se konaly norimberské procesy, ve kterých tedy západní velmoci figurovaly, ovšem musíme si říct, se Sovětským svazem, jakožto soudci, vyšetřovatelé a soudci, a že ten norimberský proces prostě, i když zanechal do určité míry rozporuplný odkaz, jakožto spravedlnost vítězů, přece jenom udělal svoje, co se týče zločinů proti lidskosti a tak dále. Ale pád komunismu vlastně vznikl za jiných okolností, a tudíž vyrovnávání se s minulostí už nepřipadalo tedy západním spojencům, ale připadalo to vládám a lidem tohoto regionu.
Thank you very much. Since we slipped into the second part of the panel, I would thank all the panelists. Their speeches or full papers will be included in the regular proceedings, as well as their drafts in the collection of drafts, so you can read them in full. Thank you, and since we don't have any spare time, I would like to call for the other part of the panel to come up, please. This is Mr. Bezák, Mr. Žáček, and Mr. Mejstřík. There's no break at the moment, just three more panelists, short discussion, and then lunch. So if anyone is about to leave, please do it now.